I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In just a few minutes, we'll hear what music is catching the ear of Amir Questlove Thompson of the seminal hip-hop group The Roots. But first, we started this program today with the first of a two-part conversation with the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, about her new memoir. We'll bring you the rest of that conversation tomorrow. We're going to end the program today with another tale of an interesting life, albeit closer to home. This one spans both the housing project of Brooklyn, New York, and the grit and glamour of the Hollywood music and movie scenes. It's Nelson George's City Kid, a writer's memoir of ghetto life and post-soul success. It's about his journey through a rough-and-tumble childhood to his career as a novelist, filmmaker, and critic, all set to the sounds of his personal soundtrack. Nelson spoke with me recently from New York, where he still lives. I asked him to tell me a little bit about his family history.
Both my mother and father, both from Newport News, Virginia. A lot of what's in that opening chapter comes from family historians and some people who've done archival work. And there's a very interesting story where apparently the original George was a white woman who had a couple of kids by a black man after Reconstruction. And they also ended up moving to Newport News precisely because of shipyards. You know, it's like the shipyards in Newport News, the Tidewater area, was kind of the way that the stockyards were in Chicago, these places where you could get employment as a working class black person and, you know, built buy a house and build a family.
And it was a classic story in another way, you know, from the rural South moving toward more opportunity as they saw it. You wrote that you were born 9 months after your parents' marriage in the fall of 1957, when your father was working at the post office via the GI Bill. And you write, "My mother was a happy young housewife. Unfortunately, little Nelson Darrell, that's me, missed all the good times and went on to become a statistic."
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, our family, if you look at that journey, they met down south in Virginia. They moved to New York in search of opportunities. The GI Bill presented certain opportunities for black men, and it also presented certain temptations. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, you can see that there was a massive increase in the amount of single-parent families among black Americans starting in the 60s and exponentially growing to these out-of-control numbers we have now. And certainly my family was part of that, so that's why I say I was a statistic. The good part of that is that it made my mother blossom. It made her go from being a supermarket clerk at the A&P or working at a bank as a teller to go back to night school, to become a teacher. And in the course of her journey to education and progress, I was a big beneficiary because the books that she brought home from school, I began reading, and that simply expanded my view of the world.
You know, one of the things I was trying to figure out how to read this book, because you write so vividly about being poor. Like, for example, you say, "To be poor is to be never quite warm in the winter, never be truly cool in the summer. It's to use a stove for heat and work your wrists to soreness trying to create a breeze with a paper fan." But you don't, like, fetishize being poor. Like that's not all there is.
That's not me. I'm not a big, I was poor. We lived in the projects. So what? I don't wallow in that, because your body is one place and your mind is everywhere else. And I'm not very tolerant of people who see being poor as this badge of honor and then use that as a way to make themselves seem larger. It's a journey. It's a step. So I'm never even, you know, I'm not really, that's not me. And that's not how I look at the world. I look at the world as opportunities and possibilities. And what I got of that experience, what I remember about the projects as much as anything, is comic books. And the guys I knew who hung out with, who I played basketball with and played stickball with, and we played all those street games that the Italians and the Jews had left us in Brooklyn, Ringo Livio, Skelly, which is a game that's disappeared, all these street games. You know, these were things that were going on in my life. It wasn't really until heroin really, really hit hard in Brooklyn and then around the country in the late 60s that I really realized that I lived in a really tough place. Because the level of, you know, the junkies, on the corners, the level of crime, the level of violence and fear, that paranoia that now we take for granted as a part of the sort of urban project experience. I didn't really realize that till I was around 10 or 11 years old, that I was living in a place. My early years were pretty blissful in terms of that kind of stuff.
Do you think that's your family? You know what I mean? What is it that allowed you to just feel that the world was your world?
Well, all of these things. I mean, my mother was her journey to educate herself was a journey that my sister and I took with her. I mean, going to see Mary Poppins at Radio City Music Hall, going to see things like Ain't Supposed to Die, Natural Death, which is a play on Broadway back then. Going to Manhattan. I remember my mother and a couple of other women in the projects taking about 8 or 9 kids to see Shaft in Times Square in 1971. And it was a field trip for all of us. You know, these things all are part of making the that's why I call the book City Kids, because the book is about city life. It's about New York. There's also a couple of chapters on L.A. and there's a really strong chapter, I believe, about Detroit. I could have written about London and I could have written about a bunch of other cities that I love, but I wanted to keep it about cities, family, and art and how those three things intertwine.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with author Nelson George about his new memoir, City Kid, a writer's memoir of ghetto life and post-soul success. And one of your tickets, your passport around all these places was music. And you were there at the creation of hip-hop, what we think of as hip-hop. You were there when it was happening. Did you realize at the time that this was something that was going to be big?
I think definitely it was new. Definitely it was fresh. How big it would be was still questionable. I figured it would be, I think I found an essay I wrote in like 1981 or 82 where I compared it to doo-wop, where I thought it would be this urban expression that would have a life, but, you know, and be part of music, but not, I don't think any of us could have conceived it would be as massive, as internationally impactful, as culturally impactful, and as commercially impactful as it's been. So going from seeing Kool Herc in a Bronx park in the late 70s to seeing DJ Hollywood at a party at City College, and again, during my college years, we knew this was different. You'd go and the way people interacted with the DJs, the way the music was cut up, was different from what disco was doing. Vivid memories of being hearing mobile DJs in the park in East New York with big, huge speakers playing Trans Europe Express over and over and over again. I mean, that kind of stuff, you never forget that. That wasn't what soul music was. It was something else.
You wrote, this is one part that cracked me up. I don't know why it made me laugh out loud, but you wrote about the energy and the violence of the scene. And you talk about, at one point, you sound like you actually kind of miss it. Like you talk about, there's this one passage where you say rather wistfully that if a concert is subpar, people just accept it and go home. I don't know. Do you miss it? With kind of the random,
well, the
random beat downs that sometimes occurred.
I'll put it this way. I'm not saying that was a good thing. I'm saying that there was a sense of danger, that rebel culture that this was about. When it was, before it was commodified, it was still kind of a folk culture. It wasn't that the culture, the music created violence. It was that people who were criminals would go to the crowd because they knew they could blend in to that crowd because they all looked the same. They were all dressed the same. They were part of the same culture. There's always this sense of something slightly out of control could happen. And once you lose that sense, then you become a marketing culture. You become a commodity. Now, you know, hip-hop means selling smart water. It means selling perfume. It means selling, you know, Heineken. What's that got to do with the culture? It's just a product. And that's the difference between that years and that danger and when it's safe for public consumption around the world.
I want to go back to your family story. And I think looking at the totality of your career to this point, because you're not done yet, I think a lot of people have always been fascinated by how you're able to do all the different things that you do. And you make a very interesting comparison to your father, who was in a lot of ways a hustler.
Yeah.
Tell me that, if you don't mind.
Well, the juggling thing. The basic thing is, you know, it was two things. One is, my analogy is when I started out as a writer, you know, you're writing music reviews. You get $50 to write a review for Rock and Soul. You get $150 to write a review for the Village Voice. I mean, so you cobble together this bit of money and manage to get together enough to pay your rent. That hasn't changed for me, that way of looking at the world, that you constantly are putting things together. And one of the key things I always tell younger writers and younger creative people is, you're only doing one thing at a time. It may seem like you're doing 4 or 5 things, but you can only really, really effectively do one thing at a time. So you have to have total concentration on that particular thing and the time you're engaged in that endeavor. And it reminds me a lot of this that's in the book, this story that Quincy Jones, I tell a story about Quincy Jones, which is both very insightful and kind of funny, I think. And where he told me about, you know, why was Michael Jackson better than a bunch of the other great talents he'd work with? And he used the phrase ass power. And he said that it wasn't simply that Michael danced well or anything like that, that he had the ability to stay in his chair at the studio and be disciplined about his vocals as I would be about my writing, to take the time to listen, go through it and perfect his vocals, perfect his harmonies, and perfect his ad-libs that we, you know, those little sounds.
Can I stop you there? Are you uncomfortable talking about yourself?
Sure. That's not what I've done for a living.
Yeah, I've noticed that because the memoir is about you, but every time I keep trying to talk about you, you're bringing in these other stories, and I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what I do.
Are you having buyer's remorse in some way that you put this story out there, but now you don't really want to talk about it?
No, it's just, you know, it's not what I've done. My natural move to the basket, you know, everyone has a move to the basket. You know, how do you get your shot off, you know, when you're being guarded, double teamed, and, you know, talking about culture in a broader sense is how I've always made my move to the basket. So talking about me as the centerpiece of the narrative is always difficult. And my editor used to yell at me several times during the writing of the book, and where are you here? Where are you at this time? Take this back. And so I had to go through that.
So let's take it back. I started with the right. quote that you became a statistic, you know, a fatherless right. child in a single parent household with a drug addicted sister. And yet you frame your story against the backdrop of the bigger story. You know, you cite the statistics about
right.
all the kids in households without dads, your father in and out of your life, not always in a good way, exposing you to things that you shouldn't have been exposed to as a young child. Is there any bigger message there? I mean, this is something that we're talking about a lot, again, as we do periodically. Do you have any word of wisdom on that?
Well, you know, I feel like when you look at the Black community, I look at progress. I'm not a half empty guy. I'm a half full guy. I remember vividly going down south, and we go to Virginia, and I'd hear stories from my cousins, older cousins, about, you know, Ku Klux Klan meetings and different kind of racist things going on down there. That doesn't happen like that anymore. The kind of career that I have, Richard Wright wanted to do a movie of Native Son. He had to go to Argentina to try and shoot it. James Baldwin wrote many screenplays in his life and never got any of them made during his life. It wasn't until Spike used part of his screenplay for Malcolm X that any of his screenplay work made it to the big screen. The opportunity to do the kinds of things I do now was inconceivable when I was a kid. But the truth is, we lost a lot of stuff that I remember. We lost this sense of brotherhood, those words not used anymore. We lost a sense of fellowship. We need to go back to the basics. I think the Black community's biggest issue is education. To me, that's the fundamental that was emphasized when I was coming up in the 60s. To get a good job, you need a good education. That was the slogan, right? We've lost that. People don't use those phrases. We need to go back to the basics. And that's what I got from the Civil Rights Movement. King read Gandhi. The Panthers read Marxists. They had educated themselves. They knew the theories. They knew the strategies for social change. They had looked at what went wrong and what went right and tried to apply it to their situation. Right now, we need a similar kind of educated urban class.
Why is now the time for the memoir?
Well, now wasn't really the time. I think I signed into this book maybe 6 years ago. And it took a while to write because I had the beginning and I had the middle, but what was the ending, you know? And I directed a film 2 years ago called Life Support for HBO. It starred Queen Latifah, and it was about HIV in the Black community, a fictional film, and based largely on the experience of my sister, Andrea, and our family in dealing with her HIV virus. And that was the ending because that film dealt with family, dealt with literature, and it dealt with Brooklyn. So it had all these different elements of my life turned together. And once that journey was completed, it felt like I had a place to stop with this.
Nelson George is author of the new memoir, City Kid, a writer's memoir of ghetto life and post-soul success. It's available now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, man.